Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a very exciting founder turned investor too, you know, and we're going to be talking quite a bit about building, scaling, financing, and all of that good stuff that we like to hear. You know, also, what was his founding journey? Why he started, you know, what he's doing now with his company, you know, basically investing, you know, in the fintech, you know, space. And then also how you really spot a company that is going to be wildly successful. Again, we have a very inspiring conversation ahead of us. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Adam Felesky. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, great to be with you.
So originally born and raised in Canada. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life?
Well, look, I was born and raised in Western Canada, which is as far from the financial services and fintech world as you can be. I was supposed to grow up as an engineer and work in oil and gas, and somehow got lost along the way. I went to university in Eastern Canada and was fortunate enough to get a job in investment banking that led me to New York and had a great but short career in investment banking and then derivatives, and then kind of everything took place from there.
And out of all things, why did you study engineering? What got you into engineering?
Because I was so bad at English and I was really good at math, and basically it was the only thing I was capable of doing.
That's amazing. Now, in your case, you know, banking, you know, that's quite an interesting approach. I think that ultimately got you into the world of financial services, you know, which is a path that you haven't really stepped out of. So out of all fields, why did you think that this field, you know, would be a meaningful one for you to pursue?
Look, I was one of those kids that grew up trading stocks even back in the 90s. And in those days, we were still reading stock quotes in newspapers. And I was always just obsessed with the stock market. So I always had a little bit of money that I had at the time invested. And so I was just kind of always fascinated by the markets. And so even though I did engineering with the idea as a backup that I could rely on that profession and probably have a decent career, I always knew in the deepest sense that I wanted to be closer to the markets.
So now, one of the things that happened in your career is that you ultimately became a founder, you know, also in the financial services space. And that happened out of all places in Toronto. So what were the sequences of events there that needed to happen, you know, for you to, you know, really venture in into the world of founding, you know, and bringing a solution perhaps, you know, to a problem that you were seeing? And I mean, it's quite the leap, you know, from the corporate world too. So walk us through what happened there.
Sure. I mean, one thing that's important is I'm from Calgary, which is similar to Texas or a Houston or a Dallas, a lot of entrepreneurial spirit. So I was always surrounded by entrepreneurs and thought that was my ultimate destiny, is to build something myself. But, you know, felt like I needed to build the foundation before I took that leap. So banking gave me a great view and perspective on different asset classes and what it takes to build a company. I then subsequently went to derivatives, which actually kind of built more on the foundation of my engineering and mathematics. And I love that because I was trading and super close to the end customers and understanding what their fears and concerns were. All those experiences ultimately led me to be able to come up with the idea to launch, which was Horizons. And you know, the details of that is, you know, on the derivatives desk, we were structuring some of the first swap-based mutual funds back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And when the market started blowing up, some of these funds were the only way to protect yourself or hedge yourself at the time. And those were specifically the inverse and leverage inverse funds in the United States. And effectively took that technology and that concept and productized it in Canada. but in this case, an exchange traded fund form.
So in this case, the company ended up becoming Horizons ETFs Management. So for the people that are listening to get it, what were you guys doing there? How, what was the business model? How were you guys making money?
Yeah, so we were the first ETF manager to launch leverage and inverse exchange trade funds focused on equity indices and commodities. In fact, in commodities, we were the first leverage and inverse index ETFs in the world to be launched. And, you know, it was a very exciting time. We kind of went through the momentum of the run up to 08 and then the ultimate collapse. And again, our products at the time were some of the only ways to get downside exposure unless you were able to use options or were comfortable shorting. So we had huge momentum. Timing's everything. And we went from a couple hundred million dollars to billions in a very short period of time. And was fortunate that type of momentum allowed us to branch out and do other adjacencies. So we also launched some of the first active exchange trade funds in the world. And those are the funds actually that, you know, amount for probably the largest share of Horizon's asset base today. So yet another innovation upon an original innovation.
So what was that journey like of scaling this? Because I mean, going from, like, as you were saying, a couple of hundreds to in the billions in no time because of those unforeseeable events that were happening there in 08. I mean, I'm sure that from a scale perspective, I'm sure that you learned quite a thing or two.
Yeah. Well, one, I had a very small team. I started the business when I was 28 years old, and I would say, thank God I did, because I was so ignorant and I had no preconception of what I was competing with, nor what it would take to survive. And, you know, that ignorance is bliss. And I think, you know, that was part of my success. Part of my learnings, and it took me a long time to figure it out, quite honestly, was how to scale the team around me. And, you know, I continue to think back of the would-haves, should-haves, and could-haves. And certainly one of my learnings was probably not building a sophisticated enough team around me to take me, you know, further, faster than I otherwise did.
Now, in this case, you know, for you as well, I mean, how did you guys go about capitalizing the operation too?
Yeah, so when I started that company back in the day, VC wasn't as prevalent in fintech particularly. So I actually bootstrapped my company and then found a small strategic investor along the way. So that created a lot of constraints. And quite frankly, I'd say the lack of mentorship that I had relative to what I see in my portfolio companies today, it was pretty isolating and you were making pretty big decisions with relatively little counsel.
Yeah, because I mean, it was a different world too when it came to fintech. I don't even know if the fintech world was coined at that point, but because we're talking about like early, like 2005 when you guys got started. So I guess, how do you see the fintech space, you know, has evolved from then, you know, to now almost 20 years ago when it comes to, you know, for example, like the regulatory aspect of it, the capital raising aspect of it, also the venture world supporting it. So how do you see it now?
There's a lot to unpack there, but you know, there just wasn't fintech dedicated funds like ourselves, and certainly the generalists didn't have dedicated fintech partners, and then the overall industry from an AUM perspective was a fraction of what it is today. You know, I think, you know, looking back, we started our first fund in 16, and that was already still kind of pretty early. And most of the first models were really about democratizing different solutions within the vertical of insurance or wealth or banking, you know, really focused on direct to consumer motions. And, you know, I think that was the right bet. I think the incumbents, you know, hadn't felt the innovation and competition from digital type players. And it was a great time to start such businesses. And you had the tailwind of ZIRP coming in to allow those businesses to scale so significantly. So it was an amazing time to scale some major winners, you know, from the Wises to the Revolutes to the Wealthsimples in our portfolio, to the Chimes and Alberts in the United States, to the Robinhoods, et cetera. And I think that, you know, our views that that was FinTech 1.0. And, you know, many of those companies continue to be established leaders. And I think it'll be very difficult for some of those leaders to be rivaled for some time, just because the abundance of capital at that time and willingness for people to experience a cumulative cash burn in the hundreds of millions of dollars is probably something that investors don't have appetite for today. So we've moved on to, I think, to a different phase. And I think it's more on the enterprise infrastructure side, where now the big FIs, you know, they're now finally all on the cloud, including insurance companies, which wasn't the case even 3 to 5 years ago. We've got AI, and I think there's serious you know, continuity risk with some of this infrastructure that these companies have been on for 20, 25 years. And so the spends on IT, like you see with JP Morgan, you know, 15 billion plus per year, that's only going to increase. And I think finally we're getting to a stage of rip and replace of major systems, which, you know, really they were focused on adjacencies and tweaking on the edges. I think the real spend's about to happen.
Now, in your guys' journey with the company, you decided to take, I mean, you were talking about it, you bootstrapped initially, but then eventually you got a strategic on board. I mean, people use the word strategic in so many different ways, right? And I think that you got to use it carefully. I mean, I find that people use strategic, you know, to the way that they will label an investor that is going to be active and is going to add value. But obviously the word strategic really carries a different connotation. So why did you guys ended up going with a strategic, and what are, how should entrepreneurs look at strategic investors?
Yeah, I'll describe my experience and I'll describe how we think about strategics today. So my experience was, one, I didn't have many choices of capital. And in this case, it was a strategic that was a publicly traded company that had made multiple investments in different companies. And the CEO at that time was a well-known entity in the market. And it, I viewed their capital as helpful, but having one mentor that was known to the market when you're 28 years old, you know, was a good choice. Now, in hindsight, did I give them too much economics? Was I too bound by their own constraints and you know, them having to answer to public markets? That definitely changed and had an impact on my destiny. So I think it's who's the strategic and how big that strategic is in your cap table is the delineation. If you look at today, how we think about strategics, I think strategics are actually becoming more and more important. If we think about the big rip and replaces in infrastructure that's going to happen and the investments that are going to happen, the amount of capital that needs to be invested up front is significant, and you better hope that you've got large customers to adopt that technology pretty early, or one, you're going to fail, or two, you're not going to raise money in the first place. So I do think strategics play an increasingly important role, but at the same time, I think it's so important that an institutional investor's at the table, hopefully with a larger ownership and more control rights, to ensure that you don't end up with a consortium discount or the company not being able to maximize their fair market value.
So then in your case, how did the whole deal-making side translate into doing a real M&A process, I mean, an acquisition, getting the company acquired? So how did that get to that point? Make us insiders there.
I've been on the journey for 7 years at the time. I was paper wealthy. My strategic investor was having some challenges, and so we decided to explore, you know, potential different avenues, including a minority investor, a control investor and ultimately resulted in a control investor. And we sold to a Korean firm called Murray Asset Management that had huge ambitions globally. And for me, it was an opportunity to continue to expand globally with an even larger balance sheet while taking some risk off the table.
And how much is the company managing today?
So they sold the Australian business called BetaShares, which was a massive success to TAA for well over $500 million. So excluding those assets, they still manage over $30
billion. Hey, guys. So pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So when it comes to timing, why did you think, I mean, you were saying that, I mean, you were at it for about 9 years plus, and you were talking about being able to get some liquidity as well for yourself. How were you thinking about timing there? And perhaps, you know, I think that this may enlighten, you know, some of the founders that are listening right now and really thinking, hey, maybe should I explore or maybe not, you know, the same.
It's such a difficult question. It requires alignment with your investors. So I think it's so important to have conversations with your investors, understand their timelines. And if there's a mismatch, be open about it and discuss how you can potentially resolve it. In our portfolio, often a CEO's lifetime is 5 to 7 years, and they ultimately are ready to do something else, or they're exhausted, and that's okay. And you know, many times you can change up a management team, you can bring people up, elevate them. The CEO can continue to have a role, a chairmanship role, and still be proud and involved in the company, and not necessarily operate it. I think too often, and in my own experience and my regret to some degree would be equating, I can't do this anymore with selling the company. I don't think those two decisions need to be, congruent. That you can move to a different role and still have a company continue on and be very successful. And for you, the founder, the potential to accrue more equity value for what you've built.
And obviously, here, first company, first exit in the multiple, you know, 100 millions, which was pretty incredible for you. Now, one thing that is interesting to me here in your journey, Adam, is that a founder is always a founder. And in your case, you decided to go to the other side of the table. So what was that thought process behind, you know, taking part in this next chapter in your journey?
I'm an entrepreneur at heart. I love meeting other entrepreneurs. I wanted to support them. So it's somewhat altruistic. I wanted to support them. I wanted to, you know, at least be a sounding board you know, be open, honest about all the mistakes I made, and hopefully they could learn from some of them. The flip side is, you know, I think I've got a curiosity in terms of what's next, and that drives me. And I always want to kind of be at the bleeding edge of what's happening in financial services. It's where I've been my entire life. And that's what gives me adrenaline, and being around smart, younger entrepreneurs and learning about their business models really satisfies a hunger that intellectually I think I always have. And at the same time, it's a way that, let's be honest, it's if you have success on the investment side, you can make returns similar to that of an entrepreneur, but in this, on this side of the fence, in a more diversified way, because you've got a portfolio of investments.
So then let's talk about the now with Partage, right? Like, how did you guys really get together here? I mean, why did it make sense to you doing it with Paul? And what are you guys up to? I mean, what is Partage all about?
Look, I met a great partner in Paul. You know, he comes from a family that's got generational wealth and thinking. And so he also wanted to make a difference and saw the opportunity to leverage his broader ecosystem, which is also financial services, in a positive way. In me, he had an entrepreneur and operator that had done it. And we felt, you know, together we could be an interesting team. So again, somewhat with ignorance, we started Portage, which initially was a primarily a seed series A fintech focused fund with small group of investors. And, you know, we were successful early. One of our first investment was a company called Wealthsimple, which is now the leading fintech in Canada. You know, at its height was valued over $5 billion. And you know, with that momentum, it's just sort of continued. And we've learned a lot and been able to invest in great companies now all over North America and Europe. We're investing out of our third fund, about to launch our fourth fund, of 75 companies in 13 countries. So if you want to satisfy intellectual curiosity in fintech, start a fund that has that type of reach. It's been awesome.
So what do you guys have right now in assets under management? How big is Partage?
We have $2.5 billion of AUM in US dollar terms. We're just about to launch our fourth fund. And then we most recently just launched a later stage vehicle as well.
So for you guys now, as you are obviously developing that pattern recognition to be able to invest in the winners, what do you typically see, or what have you seen repeated on those companies that end up something big?
So one thing I'd say, our success is that every partner on our team, and we have seven partners, has a different background. And I think their own experience skews their perspective in terms of what is a winner. But we're very respectful on our team that each person has an individual nose for success, and that's a good thing. So we don't, our investment committee isn't you know, doesn't require 100% consensus. We can have one partner really run with something, and I think that's important. So for me, because I'm an operator and founder, I really get into, like, why did you come up with this idea? Why are you so passionate about it? What are you going to sacrifice to make it real? And, you know, I think probably really understanding that the monetary potential has nothing to do with the inspiration. The best founders I've backed are really just mission-centric. And the potential future outcome, which could be wealth, is totally secondary. And I look for that.
And then also, like, when it comes to, like, the specific type of company that you guys would like to look at, whether it's sector, stage, location, what does that look like?
Yeah, at this point, we're pretty flexible. We invest in front seed stage all the way to Series C in the venture side, our later stage fund Series C, all the way to pre-IPO. About 50 to 60% of our portfolios in the US, about 20% of our portfolios in Canada, and the rest is in Europe. So developed market, those two major geographies is where we invest. And the reason for that is we have a large ecosystem in those countries. And when I describe ecosystem, it means portfolio companies, it means where our LPs are, it's where our corporate relationships are, it's where we have regulatory connections and information asymmetries. All of that together, we think, makes us a differentiated investor in those markets.
So if you were to go to sleep tonight, Adam, and you wake up in a world where the vision of Partage is fully realized, what does the world look like?
Look, I think it's quite simple. We want to be the phone call that a founder, when he wants to raise capital for someone who they believe will truly help them scale their business and be successful, we want to be the first call. And I think we're getting closer to that, but we have work to do. But that's my dream, is entrepreneurs think of Portage when they think about bringing in a partner that's truly going to be a partner.
So let's talk about phone calls. Let's double click on that. Let's say that you're able to make a phone call to that younger Adam, you know, and that phone call is being received by that younger Adam back in 2005. And you're able on that phone, you're able to give that younger Adam one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
It would be the things I don't say, actually, that would be most important. I would worry that older Adam would say, you know, you should be concerned about this, and this is going to be harder than you think it's going to be. I would really try, and the older Adam would really try and hold back and just be supportive and talk about, you know, how to surround yourself with amazing shareholders and people. And if you believe in the vision and you work really hard, it will become a reality. And just keep your head down and focus on execution, and everything else will come together.
That's amazing. So Adam, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
You can reach out to me at afileski@portageinvest.com. You can find me on LinkedIn, you can email us at info@portageinvest.com.
Amazing. Well, hey, Adam, thank you so much for coming on the show today to share your journey with Portage, and such an honor to have you with us today.
It's been great to be with you.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.